This week, President Obama proposed a national policy on web privacy, giving consumers more control of their personal information. This hour, we'll look at that proposal and tools you can use to protect your online privacy. But how easy is it for companies to get around those controls? We'll talk about it. Plus, shrinking a transistor, the basic building block of computers, down to the size of a single atom. Don't look for it in your smartphone or tablet anytime soon. And maybe the moon isn't quite dead yet. New research looking at the far side of the moon indicates there may have been recent tectonic activity there, recent being well within the last 50 million years. Plus the video pick, ice photography, all coming up after the break. Stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This week we're going to talk about national policy on web privacy. And President Obama proposed a national policy, and we're going to talk about whether it's going to be working or not, and what kinds of things have been left out, how you can protect your privacy. We're also going to be talking about a shrinking transistor, the basic building blocks of computers. There is news that a bunch of scientists have created a transistor out of a single atom, one transistor, one atom. And, you know, if you can shrink those down into one chip, the holy grail of making powerful computers is to get as many transistors as you can on one chip, of course, without melting the chip, because each of those transistors gives off a lot of heat when you get billions of them stuck together. And also, we're going to talk about the moon. Is the moon quite dead as we thought? But it's not dead yet, because there's actually evidence of activity on the far side of the moon, recent activity, and I guess in geological timescale, 50 million years is recent activity. So first we're going to go right to that moon, the transistor piece. And waiting to talk with us about that transistor piece is what do we have on the front? Michelle Simmons, of course. Michelle Simmons is here. She is a lead author on the report of the journal Nature Nanotechnology. She's professor of physics at the University of New South Wales. And she joins us by phone from Sydney, Australia, where it's really early in the morning. And we want to thank you, Dr. Simmons, for getting up early to talk to us.
That's a pleasure.
Now, you actually have built a transistor out of a single atom.
That's right. We've actually put down a single atom as the functional element of a transistor. So we've put a phosphorus atom into silicon, and the phosphorus atom has one extra electron compared to silicon, and we actually use that phosphorus atom as essentially the on and off states of the transistor.
And so on and off state meaning you can store ones and zeros in the
computer. Instead of in conventional computing, you switch it between on and off, and that's the one and zero. But when you get down to a single atom, you start to actually look at the energy levels of that single atom, and you conduct when the energy levels of the single atom are aligned with the source and the drain leads, and you're insulating when they're not aligned.
So we're not talking about quantum computing here, are we?
Well, essentially, that's what we're heading for. So in our team here in Australia, we're actually trying to build the kind of functional element, the unit cell of a quantum computer using that phosphorus atom, yes.
Mm-hmm. And now that you've gotten one atom, you need to have billions of them, don't you, to really make a functioning computer?
No. So for classical computing, yes, you absolutely have billions of transistors on a chip. Mm-hmm. For quantum computing, it's predicted that you only need tens to hundreds of atoms in order to be able to do a quantum computation.
Mm-hmm. So in your quest to do quantum computation, you don't need as many.
Hopefully you don't need as many, yeah, that's right.
I like the way you said hopefully.
Yeah. So one of the big challenges for quantum computation is to build up the number of the fundamental units. They call them quantum bits or qubits. And basically, there you if you want to make a quantum computer, you have to build up these number of qubits to make a functional system. And one of the big questions internationally is how big can you keep quantum coherence across those qubits? Mm-hmm. And that's the critical thing. And if you have to have billions of them, then it's quite likely it's going to be very difficult to do that. But if you only need hundreds of them, it's quite likely you should be able to keep the coherence across the whole system.
So then you have to physically place, sort of by hand, each one of those single atoms to make your computer?
So if you want to make, using the route that we're taking now, where we're using the electron, the extra electron on the phosphorus atom as the qubit, then eventually you do need to be able to scale it up, and that means that you have to place each individual phosphorus atom with atomic precision within the silicon crystal.
And how difficult is that?
Well, I guess the paper that we've just published is really the first time where anyone's been able to put that phosphorus atom in with, you know, one lattice spacing precision, and then align the electrodes to the atom to be able to measure its electronic energy levels. Mm-hmm. And so we've done it for one, and now that we've developed the technology to do it for one, actually the technology we've developed is actually very easy to go from one to two to three to four to five. So we're very hopeful that it's going to be possible. But like I say, the big question is whether the actual material allows you to keep this quantum coherence over a large distance or not.
That really
comes down to nature, whether it will happen.
Can you explain that a little bit more to us? What the difficulty there is?
So if you imagine in the real world, you're using an electron in a transistor,
right,
and you're carrying charge. So you switch, like we said, between on and off state. So it's like, you can kind of imagine a tennis ball. You throw it against a wall and it bounces back in the real world, and you understand that. And it's quite a robust system. Whereas when you make things very, very small, you enter the quantum world, and instead of looking at it as a kind of physical object, you start to look at it as a wave-like object. And there you can imagine if the tennis ball was very, very small and you throw it against the wall, it would actually come out the other side. So it would tunnel through in the quantum world when you make things small. And I guess that's the critical thing, is in the quantum world, things behave counterintuitively and very differently to the way we expect. And in the quantum world, you really want to be able to control those quantum states. And they're much more fragile, much more able to interact with other things around them.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been working on this?
It's a 10-year program so far. So we started about 10 years ago with the idea, could we make a single atom transistor, and then could we actually start to measure, instead of the charge of the atom, the electron, we actually measure the electron spin. And so really that's what we've been doing very recently, starting to measure the spin state of the electron. But the question at the beginning was, can you actually make it? Can you adapt the technology that exists out there to be able to put a single atom in with that kind of precision and then measure its energy levels electronically?
Mm-hmm. So can you give me an idea of the steps now that you need to go through in order to make something practical?
Yeah, well, so the technology we've developed is we take a silicon wafer, which you normally get from industry, and we put down a hydrogen layer on the surface that acts as a kind of a mask state. And then we come along with a very fine metal tip in a scanning tunneling microscope. That's a very fine metal tip that we use to pattern the hydrogen layer, where we open up regions on the surface where we desorb the hydrogen and expose the silicon underneath. And then we bring in our precursor, bring in the phosphorus atoms. We use phosphine gas, and that will only adhere to the holes in the resist layer. And so in such a way, we actually pattern the phosphorus into the silicon on that one atomic surface. And then we encapsulate that with silicon. And so basically the phosphorus atoms will stay where we've patterned them on the surface, and then we encapsulate them in a nice, robust, crystalline environment of silicon, and that keeps it protected from the outside world.
It's like a silicon sandwich you got there with phosphorus.
It is, yeah. So the phosphorus is really nicely protected inside, and it's surrounded by lots of silicon atoms. That really, we call it the host material, and that really protects it. And so really when we're going to expand to larger numbers of qubits, we literally use the same process. Instead of patterning a hole for one phosphorus atom, we will pattern a hole for many phosphorus atoms at the same time.
And why phosphorus? What's unique about phosphorous that you've chosen that?
Well, so phosphorus is great, but there's a couple of reasons. The first one is it literally has one extra electron compared to silicon. So silicon has four electrons in its outer shell. Phosphorus has five. And so when you put phosphorus in silicon, four of those electrons are used to bond to the silicon atoms, and the extra one is free. And that extra one is what we use as the conventional bit, the quantum bit or qubit. So that's one reason. The other reason why we use phosphorus and silicon is that silicon itself is a nice host material, so it has no free spins in it. So all the electrons are used for bonding, and so they basically don't interact with that one extra electron, whereas the phosphorus just literally has one extra electron, which we then control in the quantum built qubit.
Hmm. You know what I'm picturing here? If you're talking about using a few hundred, a few thousand of these electrons, and you're depositing them one at a time, and I'm sort of a picture. You could make your logo out of the
that's exactly what people have done. So the technique of scanning tunneling microscopy is about 30 years old now. It was invented in the U.S. By some researchers at IBM, and they actually pretty quickly realized that they could pick up atoms on a surface and put them down in different locations, and they actually formed the world's smallest logo, IBM, out of individual atoms. But they were picking up atoms and placing them on a surface. And I guess that's been a great technique, and they've done lots of beautiful studies of that. But really what we're trying to do is to adapt the same kind of technology to a silicon device. And the key difference there is in silicon, all the atoms bond very, very strongly in the surface, so you can't pick them up and place them. And this is why we've had to kind of develop this technique with the hydrogen resist layer.
Right.
To open up a little hole and then put the phosphorus atoms in.
Now we know why it's impressive to have small things like the size of an atom, but does that also help you speed things up at that level that you're working at?
Well, so I mean, conventionally the silicon industry, the devices get smaller, and because they're smaller, the electrons have less distance to travel, so essentially they get faster, and that's really what's pushed the existing semiconductor industry. I guess in the world of quantum computing, you're actually using a completely different way of doing the computing. So you're using what's called parallelism, quantum parallelism. So instead of doing calculations in the classical world one after the other, albeit very fast, you actually do these calculations in parallel. And there are certain kinds of calculations where if you can do things in parallel, you can get a predicted exponential speed up in the computation. And I guess that's one of the reasons why quantum computation is quite an exciting field at the moment. If you can actually realize them, then there are certain tasks that you can do that would just be much faster than you can do with classical computers.
And finally, what advantage did you have in beating everybody else to doing this?
Look, I think we're partly because we looked at a very long-term project. So we, with the Australian Research Council here, and we actually get funding from the U.S. Army Research Office, we set up this program 10 years ago with the view that it was going to be at least a 10-year project. Mm-hmm. So having funding for a long period of time, sustained funding, has been essential. But I guess also we got into the field when a lot of people were not in the silicon field. So we basically got in right at the beginning and said, look, you know, you can watch Moore's Law, which is the more that kind of dictates the silicon industry, and you can see that, you know, within a couple of decades from the time that we started, that we're going to hit the level of single atoms. Mm-hmm. And so we basically said, we're going to literally look at the technology that exists out there and adapt it to make devices in silicon. And I think it was just that we were looking a long term ahead, and with the view that we were going to have relatively sustained funding. So we just literally went for it.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be in touch. Dr. Michelle Simmons is the lead author in the report in the journal Nature Technology. She's also director of the Australian Center of Excellence for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology, professor of physics at the University of New South Wales, joining us from Sydney, Australia. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about digital privacy. President Obama, the White House, announced a proposed policy for digital privacy. What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll talk to you right after the break. Stay with us. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. This week, the White House announced a proposed policy for digital privacy, a way for people to tell companies not to track your online browsing habits, and setting up what the Obama administration called a consumer privacy bill of rights. This came just days after companies like Google were found to be sidestepping features built into web browsers designed to help consumers protect their browsing habits. So just how private can you be? Will the new government proposal change anything? Will companies find other loopholes, ways around any kind of new regulations? Are they going to be voluntary, mandatory? All kinds of stuff we're going to be talking about. Privacy of your browsing habits on the internet. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Lori Craner is the director of the SciLab Usable Privacy and Security Laboratory at Carnegie Mellon University. She joins us from WQED in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us. First, let me get your take on the administration's proposal for this digital Bill of Rights. What do you think about it?
Well, it's really good to see such high-level attention to online privacy and to see the administration articulate some of the fundamental privacy principles that a lot of us have been talking about for a long time. As far as immediate impacts for people, I'm not sure that there's going to be an immediate change that suddenly your privacy is going to be protected. But it is a step in the right direction.
And it's the president asking first voluntarily for companies to come up with some sort of standard. Is it not?
Right. The idea is to ask the industry to come together and come up with a voluntary standard that will help protect privacy.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happens when you turn on your web browser and you go to a site. Let's talk about some of the terminology first. There are two disclosures in the week or so about privacy in the browsers, both involving cookies. We've all heard of these cookies. What is a cookie? What does it do?
So a cookie is a little bit of text that's sent back and forth between your web browser and a website, and it's a way that a website can keep track of whether you've been there before.
Mm-hmm. And what does it tell other people or other websites about you? Does it tell you your social security number or anything like that? What does it say?
All it is a way to identify people. But if I know who you are, so let's say that you are visitor number 123 at my website,
right.
Then any information that I've collected about you, I can put in a database. So, if I am a retailer website and you've bought something from me, then I probably know your address and your credit card number and things like that. And that's all linked to the information I have in the database. So when the web browser sends that cookie, then the company can just look you up, and whatever information they have about you, they know, this is the right person.
Mm-hmm. And one of the cases involved Google getting around the privacy settings in Safari that involved the cookies. Right.
Yes. So one special type of cookie is something called a third-party cookie. And so a normal first-party cookie is, I go to a website, and that particular website exchanges a cookie with my web browser. But a third-party cookie is when another website that I don't even realize I'm visiting puts a cookie in my web browser. And so that might be a company that's placing an advertisement on a web page, for example. Mm-hmm. Safari web browser, the default setting is that the web browser doesn't let third-party cookies in. Just says, nope, the user wants to only get cookies from sites they know they're visiting. These other advertising sites or whatnot, they don't get their cookies in. Mm-hmm. And Google found a way around that to let the cookies in.
Wow. Is that considered something terrible in the internet world?
There are a lot of people who are pretty upset about it.
Yeah. And so what has Google said now? Will they change their policy?
Google said, yeah, we didn't really understand what we were doing, and yeah, we're changing that.
Yada, yada, yada. is that something like, if you believe that, I have a bridge for you or something?
Well, they're a big company.
Yeah. How could they not know that this is what would be happening? The other case involved Internet Explorer. What was going on in that case?
Well, so Internet Explorer also has a function where it protects people's privacy by preventing third-party cookies. But Internet Explorer is actually a little bit more complicated. In that case, instead of blocking all third-party cookies, Internet Explorer actually looks at each third-party cookie and makes a judgment about whether it's a good cookie or a bad cookie. And it only blocks the bad cookies, and bad as defined by Microsoft. And the way it decides if it's a good cookie or a bad cookie is that cookies sometimes have a special code called a P3P compact policy. Sounds kind of complicated. And so Internet Explorer reads that code and uses it to decide if it's good or bad. And so what some companies discovered is that they can lie in that code so that their cookies won't be blocked. Or even better, they can make that code basically be a non-code. So Google and Facebook and some other companies said in their special code, this is not a policy. And by saying this is not a policy, they were able to trick Internet Explorer into accepting their cookies.
Is there anything we can do as consumers to further protect our privacy when we're surfing on the web?
Well, so you can change your browser privacy settings or use some third-party software that is going to provide additional protections if you want to be able to, you know, stay in control of this. So, you know, in the Internet Explorer web browser, besides the default settings, they have something called tracking protection lists that you can use, or you can download some free software called Ghostery. Ghostery, that you can add to your web browser. There's also some software from a company called Abine, A-B-I-N-E, that you can download and add to your web browser.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255 is a number. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at S-C-I-F-R-I. Let's go to the phones to Andrew in Bend, Oregon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to phone in and address this issue that I believe this the government's initiative in this area is failing to address what I call the data collectors. These are people, large, huge organizations like LexisNexis, that buy information on individuals from all over the place and scour the internet for it, but don't necessarily have anything to do with the online visiting of websites and cookies. What they do is provide the translation of your computer's IP address or your email address, however you've logged on to those sites, and provide the demographics of who you are to agencies. I know, for instance, the police, the CIA, and all those other organizations, they rely on companies like LexisNexis, and your data is collected by them and resides in their databases forever unless America adopts the European data privacy policies that sets deadlines for how long that information can be held and your right to see it and change it.
Mm. Let me get Professor Craner, do you understand what he's talking about there?
Yes, I do. He raised a lot of interesting and important issues. So you mentioned that things are a bit different in Europe. You know, in the U.S., we don't have any comprehensive data privacy laws. We have some specific laws for things like healthcare privacy, but we don't have any overarching laws. In Europe, they do have some comprehensive privacy laws that put a lot more limits on what companies can do with your data. So here in the U.S., as you point out, we're focused on some very particular types of companies. And this week's announcement was aimed mainly at some of the online companies, especially online advertising companies, and their sort of data collection. But there are these other companies that do collect large amounts of data on people that kind of aren't really the main companies that we're talking about here. And there may not actually be any laws in the United States that specifically address the types of data collection that they're doing.
So is this like a straw horse then? Just let's throw this up that, you know, it's a minor problem, but ignore what the real big problem is?
There are certainly some people who think that, and they feel that until we get some sort of comprehensive privacy legislation that will apply across all sectors, that it's going to be the case that we're still going to have these privacy violations that aren't really covered.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Lots of people, as you can imagine, are interested. Tony in Honolulu. Hi, Tony.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, is it?
Yeah, sure.
Quick question. These companies, many of these companies are large multinational corporations. So so they're precluded or prevented from gathering this data in America. But what would prevent Google from just using a subsidiary or some other part of Google in another country from getting the same data?
All right, let's ask Professor Craner.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So many of these companies do business in multiple countries. It turns out that in some of the other countries they do business in, like in Europe, they actually have more protective privacy laws. So the Europeans are asking the same question, only what they're saying is, well, you know, we have some protections here, but what about when they collect data in the United States where they don't have those sorts of protections? But there are also plenty of countries that have, you know, almost no protections. And so in this international domain that the internet is, it gets very, very interesting as far as what happens when a company collects data in one country and uses it in another country. Mm-hmm. And some of the European privacy laws actually specifically address some of this issue of what happens when you take data across national borders.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Andrea in Moorhead, North Carolina. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you. I'm just looking at the internet as a big junk mailbox, okay? In the traditional sense, you know, we get junk mail in our mailboxes, and of course the Postal Service is now paying for that, but when they're companies, they exist to make money. So the information is not free. And I want to share a positive note. I have the Ocean Conservancy calendar in front of me. I have the National Wildlife Federation information, the Nature Conservancy, the Arbor Day Foundation, the National Gardening Club. These are things I do not on the internet, but by ordering, you know, a subscription once a year. And then, of course, I get on their mailing list. And it works the same way with the internet. So to me, I'm not quite sure all the drama around the privacy issue is really justified so much, because when you give them your information and you're buying something, you're paying for it, and they provide you a service. And yes, and then they share that information with your consent now to someone else. And so I don't know. I think the internet's the same thing. 90% of it is basically advertising. And so 10%, when you're looking for something on Google or another search engine, you're trying to find something specific, but the price for that is that you got to go through and wade through the advertising, and that's just the nature of internet.
So, Andrea, that's what you're saying, that if you're going to be a player on the internet, this is the cost of playing on the internet, and that to be
same thing. I don't know if it's right or not. It's a thought I had about it. I don't know.
Well, thanks for sharing that thought with us.
Thank you.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking about internet privacy with Dr. Laurie Craner, who is director of the SciLab Usable Privacy and Security Lab at Carnegie Mellon. What do you do in that lab over there? It's got a big name to it.
It does. It does. Well, we do research looking at the types of attitudes people have about online privacy. We look at the usability of privacy tools. We also look at security and usability. So right now we have a big research experiment going on about how to make passwords easier to use.
Oh, tell us about that. How do you make passwords? You know, because we think we have all these different passwords we have to have. Give us a secret there.
Well, one of the things we found is that you can have a really strong password if it has a lot of characters in it, a really long password. And it's a lot easier for us to remember long passwords than it is to remember passwords that have lots of funny symbols and numbers in them. You might try to think of a phrase that you can remember and use that as part of your password.
And how long should that phrase be?
Well, it really depends on the type of system you're using and how many characters they allow you to have. But,
right.
You know, if you have something that's like 14 characters long, yeah, that's going to be pretty good.
So if you use like encyclopedia or something multisyllable, even though you don't want to use a regular word. Then.
You don't want to use just one word, but you could use a string of words together. Mm. Rather than just one word. Or you could think of a phrase and use maybe the first letter of each word in the phrase or something like that.
My dog has fleas.
Well, you shouldn't do a really common phrase, though. You know, it should be a phrase that is meaningful to you, but maybe isn't the sort of thing other people would guess.
But a phrase makes it easy to remember, and you don't have to put those special characters in it. That's something I hadn't heard of before, but that's nice to hear.
Yeah, yeah. So as long as the place you're creating your password for allows it, I mean, some of them force you to put special characters. But if you're not forced to do it, this can be an easier way to remember a password.
And where should you store your passwords? Now that you have all these.
Right. Somewhere safe. yeah, I mean, it depends. But, you know, putting it in your wallet with your credit card might be a safe place if you keep your wallet secure, for example.
Mm-hmm. How about these software programs that store them for you, you know, in one central data bank? Are those good?
Yeah,
you have to remember that password, the master password.
Right. If you can remember that one master password, that can be a good solution that a lot of people use. Mm-hmm.
Should people have any expectation? I mean, our caller talked about this. Is this the price we do pay for the Internet, the expectation that you're not going to have any privacy online anymore?
Well, I think that's a pretty controversial idea. I certainly have heard people articulate that idea before, and people say that you know, something's got to pay for all these great services we have on the internet, and it's your data is how you're paying. But I think there are a lot of people who disagree with that and say that you know, people should have a choice of whether or not to reveal their data and to be tracked. And it's not just that I'm seeing an ad. You know, you turn on the TV and you see an ad, but it's that they're collecting data about me in addition to showing me an ad. And that's what a lot of people find unacceptable. You know, it should be the consumer's choice, and that if there are some services that really require money in order to, you know, make them work, perhaps they can give you a choice that you can use the service for free and provide data, or maybe you pay a small fee to use the service.
Mm-hmm. Could we adopt the European standards and feel more secure about our privacy?
Well, it would certainly be possible for the U.S. to adopt something similar to the European approach. I don't think right now there is kind of the will to do that. I think that that's been a fairly unpopular idea among regulators and legislators in the U.S., but it would be possible. Now, people say that the European notion is not necessarily a panacea either, because they've had a number of problems in actually enforcing their laws. But it is an approach to look at.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Craner. Laurie Craner, director of the Scilab Usable Privacy and Security Lab at Carnegie Mellon University. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about the moon. Yeah, some interesting stuff discovered about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/SciFry. Or you can tweet us all week long at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. When you think about the moon, once you get past thinking about Apollo, the moonlit romance, maybe cheese, your next thought is, so what? It's a big rock, a gray, dead place. But new research hints that the moon may not be as dead geologically as we might think, that on the far side of the moon, there are signs of tectonic activity recent within the last 50 million years. This counts as recent in geological time. Joining me now to tell us all about it is Tom Waters, one of the authors of that report published this week in the journal Nature Geoscience. He's a senior scientist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Well, welcome back to the program, Tom.
Hi, Ira. It's a pleasure to be back.
You're very welcome. Tell us what's the evidence of recent 50 million year old tectonic activity on the far side?
Well, it's an interesting story, and it starts not quite 2 years ago when I was on before and talked about the shrinking moon that we had located using very high resolution images obtained from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been in orbit around the moon since 2009. We saw these features, these landforms that indicate that the lunar crust was actually shrinking. It was being contracted and forming these fault scarps. Mm-hmm. So we went looking for more of these now that we are continuing to get more and more coverage of the moon with these very high resolution images. And we found something we weren't expecting. We found just the opposite of the type of landforms that indicate contraction. We found landforms that indicate that the moon is actually expanding and being stretched and pulling apart. not by much, but a little bit. And these features actually are very narrow, very relatively long troughs that are formed when the crust of the moon is being pulled apart and just breaks, and then a section of it drops down.
Well, and what would be pulling it apart?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's one of the really interesting aspects of the research that we need to continue to do, because we're not exactly sure what is causing this stretching within these small areas. Because, again, here we've had this picture of now a contracting moon. We have evidence for these global contractional faults, and here now we have
stretch marks. He didn't want to say it, so I said it for you.
Yeah, it's funny. You rack your brain thinking about creative ways of describing technical jargon. Stretch marks never occurred to me, but it's actually a very appropriate, very accurate way of describing these things. We're trying to figure out what are the forces that are acting to pull the moon apart in places that are competing with these forces that are acting to shrink the moon. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of possibilities. One intriguing one is the possibility that these areas that are actually being picked up and kind of stretched because magma is trying to rise below the surface. It doesn't make it to the surface, but it's trying to rise below this, rise up, and again, as it does, it sort of lifts it up and cracks it and stretches it. The trouble with that model is, though, that we don't see any evidence for really, really young volcanic material on the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
It's really interesting how young these features appear to be.
So do you think that there someday might be a volcano that we might discover, or one that actually spouts out and is easy to see from your orbiting stuff?
I would not say no, but I also wouldn't make any bets.
that's called hedging your bets.
Right.
But it should be. But if you're saying what you're saying, if I hear you correctly, and I'll put words in your mouth, is that if there is molten lava under the moon, it should spout out someplace.
Well, it's possible.
It's possible.
It all depends on the conditions. I mean, there are, again, other possibilities for how these stretch marks, as you described them, may have formed on the moon. And another possibility is that they are connected with the fact that the moon is actually contracting. And what happens, at least theoretically, is the moon is contracting. Blocks of the crust may actually be bent and flexed as part of that contractional process. But we still have a lot of work to understand this. Again, some of my colleagues are not particularly thrilled with the idea of young volcanism on the moon. But again, one of the things that's really fascinating about these features are their youth. I mean, we have looked at these contractional fault scarps, and we knew that they were younger than a billion years, and we knew that they were likely much younger than a billion years, maybe hundreds of millions of years old, maybe even tens of millions of years old, but we couldn't be sure. One thing that's really interesting about these very, very small, narrow graben features, as we call them, is that they won't survive long at all on the moon because they're just very shallow. And the moon is an active place in terms of micrometeorite bombardments, and soil gets picked up and deposited. And so very small, shallow depth trenches will actually be filled in. And we know this from looking at boulder tracks, of all things, boulders that had rolled down. And there's a great paper that was done in the mid-70s where an analysis of boulders that had rolled off a hill near the Apollo 17 site created a track. One of them had a track. Another one didn't have a track. And by dating the age of the boulders, we could actually date how long that boulder had been sitting there. We knew when it rolled down the hill, we could determine how quickly these trenches would fill in. So that's really exciting because it gave us another way to date these that we couldn't use to date these contractional fault scarps. So we know these trenches can't be any more than 50 million years old, but that is so recent in geologic terms, Ira, that these things could be not only just 50 million years old, they could be 10, they could be 1 million years old. They could have been active 40 years ago. And that's the other intriguing possibility is
I'm hearing the science fiction music coming up.
Well, we had the great Apollo seismic network that was on the moon put up by the Apollo astronauts and operated for a number of years collecting data on seismic activity in the moon. And the moon was active seismically very deep. But there was also a small number of moonquakes that occurred within the crust of the moon. And it's not impossible that those moonquakes are connected to these very, very young tectonic features.
So they could be really young. I mean,
yes.
40 years ago.
Yes.
Wow. And men were on the moon when they were happening.
And could be.
Does the moon have plates, like tectonic plates like we have?
No. The moon is in the—well, let's put it this way. The Earth is really unique among the terrestrial planets in that it has this mosaic of plates that shift and collide into one another or shift past one another. And again, most of the tectonic activity and volcanic activity on the Earth is concentrated at these plate boundaries. Mm-hmm. The moon is like a one-plate object. The moon, Mercury, other planets in the solar system appear to be one-plate objects. So when they contract globally, it's acting on a single plate.
Yeah. So the other question being, if the astronauts were on the moon, why did they not see any of these stretch marks on their side of the moon? And you haven't found it on the bright side, so to speak, that's facing us.
Well, there actually are some on the near side, but you're right. Some of the most exciting, actually the most exciting example that we found is on the far side. It's almost exactly on the opposite side of the moon that faces the Earth. And it may, again, be that they're just subtle forces that are acting within the moon that are creating just enough force to create these graben. It's also interesting because it tells us something about the stress state of the moon very recently. And that helps us figure out how the moon evolved and maybe even how the moon formed.
But you're not giving up. That doesn't bash the idea that it was the Earth was hit by another body and smashed the moon off as a piece.
No,
that's still
no.
the active. That's that does. This doesn't do anything to that theory.
No, this actually picks up when all that is over and the moon has actually coalesced and formed. Mm-hmm. And it's the sort of the history of the moon from that point on that these kind of observations could be very helpful in determining, again, the moon's evolution.
You know what you're doing? You're making the moon more interesting, which is dangerous, I think. Because then people are going to want to go back and study this stuff. We never thought we'd have to wonder about it, right? You know?
Well, it's true. I mean, one thing I want to mention is just, and it's very exciting. Again, this is one of the exciting things about being a planetary scientist. Right now, we have imaged less than half of the moon with these very, very high-resolution images coming back from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So we have, again, literally more than half the moon to image with these, again, very high-resolution images. And we're very excited about the idea of finding more tectonic features, more features, said more surprises. And that's really one of the exciting things about exploration.
Yeah, it is. And how long will it take to finish the job here, all those photos?
To do the job completely, we may need about 4 more years, an extended mission. It takes quite a while. We've been in orbit since 2009, and here we are 2012, and we're still collecting data. So quite a while, and we're hoping to have an extended mission that will allow us to do that.
You mean like the little Mars rovers keep going with your mission?
Yes. Well, we're very fortunate. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft is extremely healthy. We're in a very stable orbit. We could easily operate for 4 more years.
Do you have the budget for that?
Well, that's a question I can't answer. That.
As they say in Washington, that's above your pay grade. Right?
Exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, you could always hope. You know, you could point to the success and the Mars rovers and things just keep going and finish the rest of the moon.
Well, when you think about it, too, it's a great investment. We've got it's a relatively small amount of money compared to what it would cost to rebuild a spacecraft like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and put it in lunar orbit.
Well, you know, what's on your side is exploring the moon has already been thrown into the presidential race in a different context, but we might have some other ideas here.
Yes, it's possible. One of the interesting connections was the idea of whether a moon base would actually survive now based on these new findings. And I think I can safely tell you that the moon base would not be in great jeopardy unless you actually built it on a fault surface.
All right, Tom, that's quite fascinating. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tom Waters, senior scientist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, here with Flora Lichtman joining us now. Hi, Flora. With our video pick of the week, and it's really something different this time, special from coming from over the transom, as we say in the publishing business.
Absolutely, over the transom. One of our listeners, Edward Ates, submitted this video to us. He's a professional photographer and videographer, and he said that he was playing around in his studio during the winter. He does time lapse usually, and he's outside, but winter time, he wanted to have something else to explore, so he looked into ice. And this is ice like I had never seen it before. You know, we'd done a piece on ice a few weeks
ago. Sculpture.
I felt like I understood it. No.
Right.
No. There is a secret side of ice.
Love it.
That is revealed in this video. It really is so beautiful. So here's what he did. He took cross polarizers and a macro lens. And so that's cross polarized light.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like we'd put sunglasses on. Those polarizing lenses.
Yeah, and I think there's two.
Two of them.
Right.
Yeah.
And what he found was this unbelievably colorful, intricate landscape of ice changing over time. So he time-lapsed a very zoomed-in look at ice, and it's really like abstract art. I mean, he said he was kind of blown away when he saw it. It's really worth a look.
So you actually watch the ice crystals developing in many, many colors over time in his time-lapse photography.
Yeah, so he used an intervalometer.
A who?
that's what I said. So it takes a picture every 1 second or 10 seconds.
Right.
And then he put them together and made this two-minute video. And he said that I think after he had weeded out some shots, he was at 3,600 photos, I think. And that's what it made. But it really... just seeing these tiny little structures melt and reform and the colors change over time. And you know what? This is something that, you know, I knew all our listeners are just have troves of great video. I know you're out there with your video. I'm going to do the unthinkable. Please email me. My email address is, I can't believe I'm doing this, flora@sciencefriday.com. But if you're a scientist who loves video, or maybe you're a videographer who loves science, send it my way. This was really a neat find.
Yeah, this is a gorgeous video. It reminded me actually of the movie Fantasia, which I'm sure there was a fairy skating on the ice and all these crystals were forming, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And it looks just like that. It's beautiful formation, but in full color of these crystals growing.
It's psychedelic, really. I mean, it really is. And I asked if Edward had found any trends, you know, why certain colors appeared or what forms appeared when. And he said that it seemed like the bubbles made a difference. And that can be, as we know from our video a few weeks ago, how ice forms. So if you freeze ice slowly, you're going to have fewer bubbles, and that might change the structures that you get to see through these cross-polarizers.
All right. So if you have videos, if you're a scientist or you make some great, cool videos, you time-lapse, send it to Flora. Send Flora an email, flora@sciencefriday.com. We really, in all seriousness, we do want your videos, and we'll take very good care of them and distribute them for everybody to see. We'll add value to them, as they say in their business.
This one was very valuable on its own. Thank you, Edward Ates, for sending it in.
It's got music and beautiful. It's our video pick of the week up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And if you go to our website, you can also join our Science Friday growing community. And if you want to take it with you, it's going to be available in our iTunes and our Android apps. So
and podcasts.
And our podcast. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Amisha Serene Anand. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.